Okay, everyone, thank you for attending the session. If you're looking for the session Access the Local Challenge, you're in the right place. If not, you may need to be in another room. We're going to be looking at challenges to internet growth and sustainability, and particularly what can be done at the local level, what are the local opportunities, and what are the local challenges. What we're going to try and do today, we've discouraged formal presentations, so we'll have the panelists give some initial remarks, and then we really want to encourage a discussion among our panelists, and also then opening it up to the floor. So as we go through the discussion for the first part of the session, I'd really encourage you to think of questions to ask, because we really want to make this quite interactive and entertain your questions. We have a wonderful lineup for this panel. This is Dr. Nee Quainer, starting from the left. Dr. Quainer is the organizer of AFNOG, which is a technology training program and organization in Africa. He's also a professor and one of the founding fathers of the internet in Africa. We have Silvia Cardenas, who is involved in wireless access programs throughout Latin America. Christian O'Flaherty is part of the policy panel for LACNIC, the Latin American Numbering Registry in Latin America. He's also a part of an ISAC chapter in Latin America, as well as being part of IPv6 deployment and the IPv6 forum in Latin America, and is also involved with Global Crossing. Valerie DaCosta, a woman who needs barely any introduction, is the head of the InfoDev program at the World Bank. Jim Dempsey of CDT, the Center for Democracy and Technology, an NGO based in Washington, D.C., as well as offices in San Francisco. Rajneesh Singh, who's the COO of PataraNet, which is a leading technology provider in the Pacific region. He's also involved as the president of the ISOC chapter in the Pacific Islands, as well as involved in the IPv6 forum. And finally, we have David Suter, who is a consultant with a long track record of working in ICT for development. He is also a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. So with that, Nee.
I didn't expect this, but I'll try. I think the question is challenges to the growth of the net and what can be done at a local level. I will approach it this way. I think with respect to Africa, where we have practically nothing, we are just starting, you will face challenges in practically all fronts, okay? Because you're just starting, there's nothing there, so anything you touch, in essence, somebody will ask a question, and so you have to face the challenges across the whole spectrum. So you face challenges of maybe, you might say, insufficient hands-off of government from industry. You face challenges in the area of policies not being sufficiently appreciative of what the technology does. You face challenges in the regulatory environment by the regulator being too intrusive instead of rather promoting. You face challenges where the regulator actually is just thinking of revenues instead of maybe developing an industry. So it's many, legal. You see cases involving ICT equipment confiscated or seized in court for more than X years, and you know the equipment is atrophied. So having said that, I think my real push here is that we need to shift something. The early adopters of the internet, at least in Africa, were those who had to communicate with the outside world. After a decade or so, it's still the same, in the majority of the people who access the net are looking for something outside of Africa, okay? So either we find a way to reverse that by doing some behavior reform, or you have to find the right information on the continent to put it there. So my approach here says that we have to build the information resources required. We have to provide relevant information, and Africa has to communicate more with itself. If Africa is not communicating with itself, it will forever go outside 4-1, because in general, there's more outside of Africa than there is inside. But if Africa begins to produce meaningful information that it can benefit in, then it will begin to look for the information more from the inside. But let me conclude by saying that I think we should focus on building the networks, build the communities around the networks, build the institutions that support it, and in general, raise the capacity of the people who use or support these equipment. And that's the surest way to reduce the cost or improve access in general. Thank you.
Sylvia, please.
Bueno, well, my experience is about wireless technologies in Latin America and some of the other parts of the world. And wireless technologies arrive to communities where normally there is already the internet in place. And these technologies are perceived as the fashion new thing to go for the first mile or the last mile. It all depends on where you are at the equation. But these technologies have enabled not only the sharing of resources online, but also have encouraged the collaboration strategy that goes beyond the technical aspects of the networking, encouraging learning, cooperation, and negotiations from things like having a permit to share a tower, to install your antenna, to making lobby, to change the legislation of your country. Capacity building is a key element for any ICT initiative, and wireless networks are not the exception. So there is a need to take into account the translation and promotion of practical guides, not books or manuals or dense, huge materials, but practical guides, tricks and hacks on how to do things and solve problems instead of getting too much information that you can't process anyway. There's also the need to incorporate the promotion of regional talent in all that process. That is not only to be able to have access to these guides or manuals written by people from the outside, as you said, but also from technicians from our region in our language with our experiences. There is also a need to apply research and a strategy for applied research that is basically set up to support low-cost and integral solutions, covering practical aspects such as antenna recycling, calibrate and align long-distance links, things that are really, really practical and not only related to impact or what happened to a particular project or so, but to technical aspects on how to solve these problems at low cost. Other aspect is that wireless initiatives need an enabling and integral regulatory framework that covers not only the telecommunications aspects of the equation, but also, for example, electricity aspects. How to build a tower in a particular country can be that particular piece of regulation, the one that can destroy your project and is not the spectrum that is free in a particular country. There are homologation processes of the equipment that arrives to a particular country that are in charge of the organizations that started the network for the first time. And sometimes they open the market for a big company, they pay all the fees for the homologation process, and then that company has an open way into that country and they don't share that expenses, which normally can be huge. So if you want to bring a new, brand new device that is low cost, that uses low power, that is resistant for many things like dust and heat and all, then you will have to do that for the manufacturer, which is kind of not fair. There's also a need to work on the regulatory aspects of country borders, where communities are separated by only by these imaginary frontiers. And then indigenous communities are one side of Peru and the other side of Bolivia, and they have this wireless network, and they are doing illegal things in one of the countries or two of them. because there is no dialogue between these two regulatory bodies. Also, there is one thing that I really, really want to emphasize is that rural communities should not be treated like as an exception of a norm. I think it's the other way around. Now, regulations are settled by for cities, and then when you're talking about rural areas there, you have to modify the legislation and do a new norm only for the rural areas. It shouldn't be the case. They should be like the starting point and be included for the, from the beginning. And also, there is a need for services and application in rural areas, such as voice, messaging, and emergency services that are that need to be granted, encouraged, nurtured, and supported as a right that is before any economic interest. And that is reflected on many regulations of our countries in all over the world that said, let's say 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz are free, but voice over IP is forbidden. So, and what the people wants to do with 2.4 and 5 gigahertz is voice over IP. So it's that kind of thing should, you know, we have to discuss about that and find a way to move to the snake.
Thank you, Silvia. I'd like to address the access problem from a more technical point of view and talking about the infrastructure and how the internet economics works and what can we do in those places that are challenged regarding the penetration, the usage of the internet, and how does this internet economics can help, and what are other experiences that can help to those areas to improve their services, their connectivity, their performance, and lowering their costs. Because in many, many cases, the main problem is related to prices or costs or lack of infrastructure. And the simple solution for most of those isolated places is a satellite connection, an upstream connection, a single connection to the internet somewhere, and this is the most expensive way to connect to the internet, and we don't get the benefits of the network or the internet economics using these single connections. So I think that there are many ways that small cities or even towns that if they work together, if they are aware of the way that the network is built, and if they realize that each of their users or customers is part of the network and is adding value to the network, and if they get interconnected before buying an upstream connection or in addition to an upstream connection, they will be able to lower costs, and there will be other businesses that will appear which will enable more access and more content to be installed local, and there will be cases where data centers can be built very small. They don't need to be like the carriers, hotels we know. The very small places can work as a data center for a local community, and providers from different towns can interconnect to each other to get benefit or of this content. Consider that when traffic is exchanged between two customers, the provider is charging twice for this content, and if this provider interconnects to other providers in the same region, which perhaps it's a very cheap circuit because there are towns that are not far away, or perhaps two providers, two networks in the same town or in the same city can exchange traffic for free, and instantly a business will appear to content providers within this region to host their content there, and more local traffic and more performance for their own traffic will result in better access in this area. If they rely on the traditional reselling of the service, the problem they have is that they are having very expensive costs in a region with very low budgets. So we should start this virtuous circle, the internet economics, on those places, making people aware of the benefits of interconnections, on deploying exchange points on their regions, on convincing the networks in each town or city to connect to those exchange points and to pay for the circuits, because perhaps on a first simple analysis, it's easier and cheaper to have a single connection to a single transit connection, a single connection to the rest of the internet, but they won't be able to get the benefits of the network if you stay with this situation. So our challenge for those places with this lack of interconnectivity between providers is to make them aware of the internet economics and how beneficial are to make local exchange of traffic. And nowadays there are several networks to distribute content who will realize that there will be places to install their own servers, and those networks at their own charges will place those servers there, and all the region will be beneficiated with those installations, because those networks charge the content providers, who get the benefits of better performance from the customers in a particular region. So I think there are many things in the internet that can make this happen, and we should make aware to those local small providers of these benefits.
Hello everyone, can you hear me? Yes, I'm Valerie DaCosta. I'm the program manager of InfoDev, which is the Information for Development program. It's a multi-donor program that is housed at the World Bank, and the World Bank itself is an important donor to the program. I think that in terms of some initial comments, we have heard many times about the access problem. So it's a problem. And I think it does remain a concern from the perspectives of coverage, costs, service, content. But I also want to say that I think that there's enormous progress being made. And if we didn't only think of connectivity and access in terms of a computer, I was struck by a comment made in Kigali. I was in Rwanda 2 weeks ago, as were some of you as well. And it was said that in the next 15 minutes, 15,000 new mobile subscribers would be signed up, and most of these would be in the developing world. And the largest trajectory of growth for mobile is in Africa. So I don't know if that's verifiable independently, but what I want to say is that there's also enormous hope and progress if we didn't think only in terms of a computer, but if we were to think of access in a broader way, which is one thing that I'd want to say starting out. So yes, there are concerns, there are problems, but let me offer three thoughts. Perhaps they might be somewhat random, but these are thoughts I think that are circulating within InfoDev and its community. I think the first is the need to look at access issues from the perspective of the user. So perhaps some call this the content question. But really, to what extent are we looking at the demand drivers for the access to infrastructure that is being planned? To what extent really is a substantive, useful, relevant content being created for the people that we intend to benefit from all of this? And I think this is a particularly exciting question when we think about the new, very participatory forms of media that are emerging. This is something that I think bears some thought over and above the infrastructure questions, which cover questions such as cost and connectivity and so on, which I think are also very relevant. The second thing I think, perhaps this comes to me because InfoDev is a donor-funded program. Our donors ask us all the time, where is the development impact? And one of the things I think is worth discussing and also studying a little bit further as we go along, and I hope to do this in the not too distant future, is what happens in a village or in a community when there's access to a mobile phone or to the internet, and I won't say to a PC. How many jobs does it create? How can you measure the impact of the effect that has on lives, whether it's economic development, whether it's an improvement in the governance or their ability to transact with a local authority or a municipal authority, whether it makes them happier because they're able to be entertained in a different way or communicate within the village and beyond more effectively. So I think one of the things we're going to have to think about further as we discuss the access question is what the impact on development and in overall the improvement of life and the reduction of poverty means. I hope that at least with InfoDev we can study this going forward. I want to also link two points that come to me fairly regularly from different stakeholders of InfoDev. We have client countries who say to InfoDev, can you do a study for me to tell me how to spend this universal service fund that I've collected better? Because I've got this ton of money and I need to spend it, but I'm not quite sure how. Well, then I go into another meeting with other stakeholders of InfoDev where I'm told, could you help to fund this community-based access solution that I'm in charge of? Now, you see, I'm going to put a little microwave tower here, and then what'll happen is, you know, it links up this one village. And I wondered to myself, to what extent are we engaging those who manage universal service funds to say there may not be just one way to skin a cat here? And to what extent could universal service funds be more properly allocated, maybe on a competitive basis, to fund community-based access solutions that I see springing up everywhere? Now, we know Grameenphone, it, you know, is very popular, but there are hundreds in countries that InfoDev serves. And making that link for those of you who manage those funds and regulators, and I used to be one myself, but that link between community-based solutions and access that doesn't refer only to an incumbent telco rolling out telephone lines, but widens the concept a little bit. So a couple of random thoughts, Karen, but I just place it forward and hope that that stimulates debate.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Again, I'm Jim Dempsey with the Center for Democracy and Technology. And it, you know, we have here a contradiction, which is that we've made tremendous progress in the development of the internet, certainly remarkable progress worldwide, faster than any other medium previously. And yet at the same time, we have this deep-seated concern and frustration over the unevenness of development, and particularly this concern over the failure to make progress in a number of countries, particularly the developing and transitional countries. And for me, that's a conundrum. Why has progress been so uneven? Why has it been inadequate and unsatisfying? And it poses the question of, is there something that we should be doing differently? Now, I'll preview for you the end of my conclusion, which is, I have not yet found anything new under the sun. I would like to know, and I would like to hear, and I, to some extent, came here to Rio to learn, is there something new under the sun? It seems to me that for the past decade, if not a little bit longer, there has been a dominant model worldwide for ICT development. And that model has been based upon competition, interconnection, and the universal service concept. You could say that a fourth pillar there has been privatization I think we've all seen in different countries the sort of mistake of putting privatization, for example, ahead of competition and simply replicating a monopoly, shifting a monopoly from a government-owned monopoly to a private sector monopoly to get you nowhere. So I would almost even, to be a little provocative, leave privatization off the table almost, but certainly putting the emphasis on competition. Now again, why has this not worked? I think it has not worked, at least my conclusion is, because it has not been sufficiently, consistently, fully implemented. And I would illustrate that in the following way. And by the way, an interesting question here is the meaning of the word liberalization. Liberalization has been the word used to describe this dominant regulatory paradigm, meaning a denationalization of the PSTN of the public switch network and the movement to a national regulatory authority, private service providers, etc. And I really think that if you look at five questions or five reference points, the answer to those questions will tell you a lot about the state of internet development and access in that particular country. First, does the country have one or more internet exchange points? In some countries, for a number of years, internet exchange points were prohibited, that ISPs could not get together, that for some reason it was considered to be outside of their charter, outside of their license. At a number of countries, I think that progress has been made overcoming that issue, but certainly any country that does not have an internet exchange point, it basically says, to go to Niamh Quaynor's point, that it's more important to get what's outside the country than to get what's inside the country. And there is this virtuous cycle that Christian referred to. But number one, is there an internet exchange point, and are there barriers to the creation and management of an internet exchange point? Secondly, licensing requirements for ISPs. Is there still a requirement that to be an internet service provider, you need an individually granted license? I think that any country that is still operating under an individual licensing system, a pre-approval system, as opposed to either a blanket license or a no licensing requirement, is likely to be more behind in internet development. Third, of course, is the monopolized telephone provider, and the question of who controls internet access and whether there is true competition or not. Fourth would be spectrum and spectrum management, and looking at how the 2.4 and the other broadband wireless technologies are being controlled. Are they regulated? Are they unlicensed? Are they delicensed? And what can they be used for? And then fifth, and sort of what I would say is the litmus test, is voice over IP legal? Or are there limitations one way or the other, technical or regulatory, on the use of voice over IP? It may well be that if you talk about the virtuous cycle and you talk about sort of where is the value of internet access, if you're in a country that starts with a poor economic system in the first place, if you start with a country with high poverty rates, what is the attraction of the internet and what can begin to create that sort of virtuous economy? It may be that voice over IP is the killer application, particularly for illiterate, when you think about it, for illiterate populations. So, at the end of the day, I sort of come back to, and again, I'm open to persuasion on this. I would love to have somebody show me that there's something new under the sun here. But at the end of the day, I come back to the fact that it's not that there's anything wrong with the dominant regulatory paradigm. It's that we have not conscientiously followed through on that regulatory approach, and that instead the monopolies have been allowed to continue to keep prices artificially high and to limit uses like voice over IP. Now, the interesting question, final question I would have is what is the role of government? When should government be active and when should government be inactive? And I'll certainly, I think that government should be active in enforcing competition, that is, active in enforcing the fair rules for private sector innovation, competition, development, entrepreneurship. Clearly, the government has a role on the content side to some extent, clearly on the training side, also, I think, on the public access point side. If people are to see the value of this technology, it will partly come through the public access points where I think the government has a huge role. So with that, I'll turn the microphone over. There are people like Raj on this panel who are actually in the trenches doing this. I just talk about it. So between him and me and Christian, you have people who actually know what they're talking about.
I've never been accused of knowing what I talk about, so it's interesting.
There's always a first.
I'm Rajnesh Singh. I'm basically currently based in the Pacific Islands, and the perspective I'll give you is what we live, learn, and do in the Pacific on a daily basis. Now, if I ask a typical internet user in the Pacific, what's your problem with internet? They usually come back with two issues. One is it's not fast enough, and two is too expensive. The rest of the stuff comes later, that there's no content, maybe they want localized languages, and so on and so forth. But the two main underlying issues are the cost and the speed. Now, that's putting it very simplistically, of course, because they are contributing issues which lead to high costs and low bandwidth. And I'm sure pretty much all of you here realize and do know what those issues are. If I go through the issues, each panelist, even though we are quite diverse here, we've actually already touched on those issues already, and I'll just run through them for you. There are geographical issues. In the Pacific and in large parts of the developing world, we have distance and terrain issues. The Pacific in particular is very famous for its natural disasters, particularly cyclones. So it doesn't help when a cyclone blows through and takes out all your communications equipment. You know, dishes start flying away, towers fall down, and so on and so forth. So it doesn't help. Now, being a remote location makes it even worse, because getting the logistics in place to resupply or rebuild that communications tower or whatever it may be, it's pretty hard. It's not easy. There are infrastructure costs, and a large part of the infrastructure costs actually come out of logistic costs. Sometimes you have to charter a ship or a plane to take stuff somewhere, and you know that gets really, really expensive. And with the rising oil prices, it doesn't help. Small commercial markets are probably typical of just about every Pacific Island country we have. This means there's limited consumer spending. Some of them basically have subsistence livelihoods, which means they don't really earn a regular income. So expecting them to pay for excess costs doesn't work too well. Moving on, there are human resource issues. That includes technical capacity as well as policy capacity. As Jim and Valerie have touched on, and others as well, there are regulatory and monopoly issues. Typically, you will see that the telecom provider is a monopoly. They are basically a remnant of the old government system, the old post and telecom department, perhaps, which has evolved into a company now. They normally always are also the largest, perhaps one of the largest employers. They are a source of funding for other organizations within the country. So there's a large part of what I'd like to call community service that the telcos do. So therefore, that puts them in a rather influential position. And competition is nice. I mean, I absolutely agree with competition. But sometimes you need to look at market realities as well. If you only have 3,000 or 4,000 people living in a country, you begin to wonder from a commercial perspective of how sustainable competition could be in the long term. Short term, yes, but long term is where it makes a big difference. Now, after we go through all that, there's one other problem that always pops up, and that's the lack of political will to effect change. Governments typically say, yes, we want to do this, this, and that. However, they have other priorities: feeding people, clean water, sanitation, electricity for the villages, transportation links between islands. Now, these are much, much higher priority items than providing internet access, even though we may say now that you need ICT for development and so on and so forth. But when a country has a limited budget, and some of these countries only have a budget of $10 million US to spend on public infrastructure, where will that money go? Okay. Now, having said all that, how do we address some of these issues? One thing I like to keep on saying and emphasizing is that, you know, there must be use of appropriate technology. I mean, dropping a thick optical pipe into a country, yes, it sounds great, but it really must be appropriate, it must be feasible, it must be sustainable. In the Pacific, we tend to say that radio is king, broadcast radio. Most people depend on broadcast radio. Even today, you know, it's what it was like 40, 30, 40 years ago. You know, the BBC World Service is very popular, for instance. Shortwave radio is used. And often, broadcast radio is the primary means of communication, or at least to gain information. And what interests me in recent times is this satellite-based radio, broadcast radio systems, which actually give you a one-way path to the internet. And that's, I think, that is something that could be tapped. Perhaps my colleague from InfoDev could consider that as a possible solution in some situations. Cellular phones, again, that's already been touched on. That is really perhaps one of the easier methods to gain access or to solve access issues. You know, technologies such as WiMAX are great, but sometimes simple Wi-Fi is even better because it's cheaper, easily deployable, and it can be easily fixed if it breaks down. Optical fiber and local infrastructure, again, great where it can be sustained and where it's feasible. The notion of regional networks and bandwidth aggregation, I know in the Pacific our telecom colleagues are already working on that, and hopefully they'll come through in the short to medium term. IXPs, which has been touched on already. Yes, when there's more than one ISP, IXPs come into play. And once regional networks evolve, a regional IXP becomes all the more important. Now, moving on to some of the more policy-based issues, one of the things that I always find rather amusing is that every island country, and again, I'm talking for the Pacific here, wants to formulate a national ICT strategy. They spend a lot of time talking about it, asking for donor funding to, you know, come help us do it. The problem is, they try and replicate something which is done in some, how shall I say, a much more developed country, which is not sustainable at the local level, because the scenario is completely different, the situation is different. Now, when they do get around to formulating it, so a nice thick document is created, it's talked about, it's maybe shown around to donor agencies, and it's filed into a cupboard and locked away. There's very little done to actually implement the policy. And that's where I think donor agencies can come into play, where they're saying, yes, we'll help you formulate it, but let's now go and implement it. I think some donor agencies need to concentrate on the implementation stage rather than the formulation stage as well. I would also hope then when national ICT strategies are formulated and implemented, they also embrace new technologies, the concepts of convergence, IPv6, voice over IP, and other such technologies. For, you know, one of the reasons in the Pacific, and I'm sure in other developing regions as well, people say that internet access in the US is so cheap, and I wish we could have the $40 a month access charges at, you know, a T1 sort of data rate. One of the reasons it's cheap is because most of the US content is local. It's hosted local. There are no international transit charges. You do not occupy satellite bandwidth or optical bandwidth to deliver that content. So once we start building local content, things will get cheaper because the telecom companies will find it cheaper to provision the service. And then finally, one of my pet projects is capacity building. There are two sides to capacity building. One is the technical skills, the engineers, the network operators who will build, run, operate, and maintain the systems. The other side of it is that one needs to build skills to engage with technology for productive use in the community. So you've got your technical capacity building, but then once you are able to deliver the access, once you have internet access available, you need to be able to have communities which are able to use the technology in a productive manner, not just to surf porn. So, and other things too. So what we are trying to say is that, you know, there should be some group and community-based initiatives which educate people on using technology. Telecenters are a great concept when they are delivered properly. I think I'll stop there and I'll pass on to David. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to come at this question from a slightly different angle, perhaps more than a slightly different angle. I'd like to look at it from a perspective of development policy rather than communications policy, from the periphery rather than the center, from issues of demand rather than supply, and from issues of usability rather than connectivity. In other words, what I think I want to do is to look at a different question from what we normally ask when we talk about access. Very often when we talk about access, we look at it from the supply side. We look at it from, we seek to answer the question, how do we here, we ICT professionals at the center, in the population heartland of a country, how do we reach them over there in the far corner of the room? And the question which I think is more important to answer, or the questions that are more important to answer, are questions that are rooted over there in the far corner of the room. The questions that people are asking there about how do we get access to these things that we have heard of that we think might be useful to us, that we can define would be of value to us. In other words, I want to look at the perspective from the demand side of the community and of the individuals who are on the margins of connectivity, not from the center of the supply, from the large-scale centralized networks and the economics and technology of those. So I'd like to make four points about that. The first of which is actually a very positive one, the second and third of which are more to do with asking these questions about the demand side. The first point is to do with supply. I think we're in danger sometimes of forgetting just quite what astonishing changes there have been in communications connectivity in developing countries over the past 10 years. In the past 10 years, we have seen a move from virtually zero connectivity outside urban centers and outside the rich to mass markets for mobile telephony on which many other things can be built. And those mass markets are continuing to grow very fast. If you compare that with the other infrastructure deficits that rural areas of developing countries face, that is an astonishing rate of growth. It's a greater achievement than a century of attempts to bring power or clean water or adequate road systems has managed to achieve. So we should see that as something on which we can build greater local access in the future. Plus, it's, I think, very important to recognize that it's a state of flux, not a status quo. That the extent of communications connectivity in rural areas is constantly changing and growing. So any policies that we design that are to suit needs as we see them now are going to be out of date in 2 years' time. We need policies that are designed to work in a state of flux. Second point and third point I want to make are about the demand side. And in particular, I'm looking at the furthest reaches of connectivity. If you're looking at communities in the furthest corners, the communities that lack access of any real adequate kind at all, what you're talking about is communities that live in a state of multiple deprivation. It isn't just communications networks, which they don't have. They're typically much poorer than other parts of the country. They're typically politically marginalized as well as economically marginalized. They're often ethnic minority areas. They've usually got very low health and education standards. They've got much less chance of meeting the standards that are set out in the Millennium Development Goals and so forth. In particular, they have shortfalls at every infrastructure network. The shortfalls in water, in power, in roads, in financial services, in health, in education, as well as communications. Now, if you live in a community like that, you don't isolate communications as a problem. What you see is a whole set of interlinked community problems. And I think actually that we, as communications professionals, also need to look at communities that we are seeking to reach with connectivity in that particular sense, to look at them as communities that live in multiple deprivation and to see where the linkages between our networks and other networks come together. Build those synergies together and you have something that I think is both developmentally more effective and also provides more effective business models. The other side of this is the individual, marginalized individuals, individuals without connectivity. Now, typically, if simply providing connectivity does not provide access to people. Access is also determined by the demand side of this. And the demand side is, I think, boils down to three main things for an individual: to affordability, to what I would call saliency or relevance of the potential use there, and that includes content, but it's more than content. And thirdly, to ease of use, which is the point that were made, I think, being made a moment ago about capacity. People can only make use of connectivity if they can afford it, if there is something that they can get with it that is worth their while affording, and if they have the skills or can easily gain the skills to achieve that, to bring that to them. Now, the more complex the technology, the more difficult it is for people to gain those three demand-side objectives of affordability, ease of use, and saliency. In particular, the poorest within any community are likely to be most disadvantaged in doing so because they're likely to be least literate, likely to have least educational skills. In the case of the internet, likely to be least able to translate data which they see on a screen into something that has actual meaning for their practice as parents, as farmers, or whatever it might be. So I think we need to pay much more attention to, when we're trying to address access, to going beyond connectivity to those demand side factors. And my final point is that I think we need vastly more evidence about this as well. There is no area of development policy I know which has less adequate an evidence base than ICTs do. We really need to build that, and we need to build a strong understanding of the people in the periphery and of how their behavior, their priorities, their needs, based on what they say to us. Thank you.
Karen, why don't you?
Can you hear me now? Great. Well, this has been, I think, a really quite fascinating discussion because we have such a diversity of panelists from many different backgrounds. And we're coming back in many ways to an issue of what do we do about looking at the demand side for the internet, which I think in many ways is quite a fundamental shift of where we have been for the last 10 years looking at supply side and regulatory, which is also a very important issue, which I hope we can discuss in the questions. So one question that I have then, a lot of it is about local content, what do we do and how do we drive local content? And what does local mean? And how local is local content? Do we need to get down to the very local municipality levels? Is regional level sufficient? National level sufficient? So I'm wondering if we can have a bit of a discussion about how we drive that demand. And another interesting area that's related to this, I think that as we go down, as you said, David, in terms of looking at internet penetration, and now we are getting down in many ways to communities that have a lot of competing issues that are less technically literate, how do we address the demand side then in that area as well? Christian?
Yes, regarding the local content, I've mentioned this virtuous circle which will result in those interested in providing this content to host their content, whatever it is, web pages or videos or whatever, in those places which makes more economically and from a performance perspective point of view more adequate. So if there are many upstream links, for example, satellite links connected to the states on a region, where the most appropriate way to host their content will be a cheap data center provider in the state. But if there are networks in those regions and there are exchange points or providers who have focused on data center facilities or something like that, those places naturally will be the preferred places for those who has this content. And I'm sure that if there are places like this, a lot of people that are not thinking about providing their content, for example, small shops or communities or many, whoever is interested in showing what he's doing, if there's something local available, he will be able to make his content there easier. If he has to deal with a provider outside, he's not going to be involved on those things. And I don't want to mention just the content as the regular web page for a shop, for example. When he mentioned the voice over IP, this is going to be a driver to make this circle work. And there are many other drivers, like the peer-to-peer applications, which will start using those direct connections between those towns or cities. Also, there are things like Wi-Fi or cheaper last mile connections, who will let permanent connections to they will enable other ways to use the internet for those who are not thinking in having something connected and using the services available when something is connected all the time. So perhaps there are many things that we are not thinking about right now, but as soon as we deploy the network on those places and the network is available, it will be as a small scale internet on those regions.
Go ahead, Jim, Sylvia, and then me.
Let me give one small example, which anybody interested should definitely take a look at. And it goes to the point about looking at this from a development perspective. In Macedonia, recently, a project that I was only indirectly affiliated with, but I'm familiar with, put the government job application process online. In Macedonia, as in many other countries, the government is an important employer, and now in Macedonia, the bottom line is that I think 75, if not 80% of all job applications for government employment are filed through the online job application system. And this is in a country that has something around 5 to 10%, probably not much above 10% internet penetration. How does that work? Well, it means that a lot of people are using public access points to file their job applications for government employment. And why are they doing it online? Because in the process of creating this sort of value, the saliency point, the people doing this reformed the system for applying for government jobs. It used to be, it used to cost something like $50 to apply for a job, because you used to have to go and get certified copies of all of the, of your school record and of your police record and et cetera. They eliminated a lot of those requirements so that only the person finally selected for the job. It used to be that every applicant for the job, and there'd be 100 applicants for the job, all 100 applicants had to get all of their records first before they could even be considered. So that had nothing to do with internet, but it had to do with looking at it from a development perspective and saying, we're going to change the way that people apply for government jobs. Also, of course, when it was done face-to-face, there was a bribery element to it, and getting your application considered required paying money. Now, with it all online, it's much more transparent and the opportunities for bribery are less. So that, I think, is one small example of focusing on the content side, the value side, the demand side, and then using that to drive and to create that virtuous circle. Anybody should take a look at that Macedonian program.
Sylvia?
I want to add that sometimes when Jim mentioned that there is nothing new under the sun, it's because we are all so much into doing things that we forgot to document what we do in a way that other people can understand what we are doing. So a lot of the effort that from our perspective we think that should be done is in, again, the same effort that we have been doing for years about case studies, but in a comparable way, where you document something that is not relevant only for you, but is relevant. It is documented in a way that you can compare your initiative to somebody else, and also the biographies or the CVs of the technicians or the people, the communication people that are working on the field, that are the ones that hold the key on how to move in a particular area. And then we end up without having the value of the expertise of inside a region just because we don't know that person in particular. So sometimes it's not huge databases with neat searchable engines and nice colors, but simple biographies that helps break the ice and get to know one another and find that particular person that I'm sharing interest in common ideas or common problems, and then solve the things together. And there is also the time that we need to go through the documentation of meetings and workshops and encuentros, gatherings of different people doing things that we weren't there, but there was a place where the thing that we wanted to do was solved or discussed or advanced. But we are so concerned about our little grain of sand that we didn't see the ocean. So I think that we need to be more cautious about what things we need to document about our own projects and initiatives in order to better communicate with others and produce not the website, as you mentioned, not the place for everybody to go, but one page with your experience and who are you and what you're doing, that will open the door for many things to happen.
Nee.
I just want to give a slightly different twist. I started by saying that we're in a new environment, and there everything is a challenge. Imagine just for a moment the blind leading the blind. Policymaker is blind, technician is blind, consumer is blind. Just go figure it out. Having said that, let me move from web, mail. I suspect that we are serving an elitist community, okay? What does it take to provide email for everybody in the country? I mean, I really don't understand. Yet you go to a minister's office, he has a nice computer, and then he has an email address from outside of the ministry, maybe outside of the country. So I'm suggesting that we have not adopted the information society yet. If we had, we'd be concerned about communicating with the person in the rural area. And if we did, we'll make sure that he has a way of getting access to his email. We are not doing that. Instead, what you have is big words, lots of talk, you know. But we must focus on solving the problem of the ordinary person if we are to have the internet have effect on his life. And it's not that difficult, except that we get trapped into high speed, this, high. Look, even if you give the guy in the village 9.6, he'll be happy. He'll be very happy. He doesn't have anything. So all this is theory, you know, but the real thing is let's just get it out there and have people experience it.
Valerie.
Well, I just agree with Nee. I think although we think of issues in terms of connectivity and cost, as Raj was saying, which I agree, but you've got to be doing that. It's got to appeal to you because you want to use it for a purpose that you need. And so it seems quite simplistic. First of all, I have to say, somebody's having a huge party outside, so you must all be very committed to access to be sitting in here. But I think what Nee says is so simple that maybe we forget to think how true it is. So as we plug along in terms of high-speed bandwidth, if we thought about ICTs from the perspective of the user, it's a point that I made, David made the same point, demand drivers. Wait, what's your problem in your community? What's something that you have to travel 3 days in order to do? Or what sorts of diseases are you facing? Or how would you like to interface better with your local or municipal authority? What is killing you right now that you simply can't get through to them? Or speaking to people who run small and medium enterprises and asking about the market that they are trying to address. Where are you trying to sell these goods? To whom? Physically? Could you do it virtually? In other words, tailoring ICTs to the problem is something about mainstreaming the use of ICT in an issue rather than talking about ICTs for ICT's sake. And I think because Nee's logic is so simple, I think we sometimes think it has to be more complex. It's got to be about market liberalization and it's got to be about this and that. And I think these are all critical factors. But content, I believe, is what ultimately will drive access. It will ultimately drive usability and relevance to the lives of people who today are unconnected. We're not talking about the elite, but those who still fail to be connected. So I just want to add my voice to his.
We've got a question from the floor.
Yes, Suhaib Marin from Alcatel-Lucent. Are you hearing me? It's okay. I cannot agree more with what has just said Valerie, that this is precisely what we are doing in our Digital Bridge Initiative, for instance, where we are looking for partners who develop local content. But I think there is a cultural problem that most often we technologists don't know those partners. For instance, we in Madagascar recently, we are working with ATD Force Word, which is a leading NGO in France dealing with extreme poverty. And they are conducting a program in Tananarivo. And we are working with them because they are providing the content for a very deprived population. So I think that there is a cultural problem that we need to work with people that we are not used to work with. I'm just a suggestion. The second point I want to make is to answer the challenge of Mr. Dempsey. You are right. What is new under the sun? I dare this explanation, and I would like to have your comment. When telecom liberalization occurred in developed countries, we had at least national champions brought under the regime of monopoly, I agree, but we had national champions. The problem in Africa, I think, is that we have moribund monopolies that are saved by the government by not allowing voice over IP to keep the cash cow of international call. But the problem is that those moribund monopolies, the lack of national champions, are hindering the availability of backbones that are essential for the development of the sector. And the countries of Africa that are behaving well are those who have national champions. I dare to cite, for instance, the case of Senegal, where you have Sonatel, which is a sort of national champion. But the other extreme, you have countries like Democratic Republic of Congo, where the incumbent has only 20,000 lines in Kinshasa, half of them are not working. And mobile operators are deploying their own backbones. So the answer, as InfoDev has made 2 years ago, is open access. But open access means maybe that people have to sacrifice part of their investment for the public good. And this is something not as evident as it is. And the difficulties faced by ESI, and this is an issue that was touched in the first access workshop earlier this afternoon, is an example, is a case in point. Because people who are putting money don't want to make this money as a public good. So I think that maybe the difficulty lies in this, in the absence of local champions.
Any response?
Well, I would only say that the EC process, so to speak, I mean, is worthy of study in and of itself, and what has gone right and what has gone wrong there in terms of the different players and where the barriers have emerged. I would say that the sort of declining nature of the landline infrastructure in a number of countries, the only promise that I see there is on the wireless side, where I think competition has worked on the wireless side, increased access, lowered prices. And now the question is whether the mobile phone can be truly used as a internet access device, and whether there is content that suits the needs of people through that through the mobile device. And it may be, I mean, a radical thought, but you may see almost a withering of the traditional PSTN copper wire network, and sort of a leapfrog over that. But that's just speculation.
I like very much the example that you gave about Macedonia, because I am a very firm believer that the government has a big role to play in creating the demand and the offer for ICT. So I was wondering if all of you guys think that the government should be more active, creating and identifying these kind of opportunities from the local communities that could be provided by means, for instance, of e-government, means, for instance, of the people paying taxes online that could save them money in terms of reducing the cost of traveling, maybe because of bureaucracy, this kind of, applications, for instance, for them to communicate with their families, for the families that live overseas to send them money electronically, or things like that, you know, kind of applications that are very related and specific to communities, and that could be provided by the government.
I wanted to respond that. I think that as the role of government should be to provide the enabling environment to do so, to encourage organizations and universities, NGOs, institutions to do that, to create the policies and open the spectrum and the whole spectrum of things so things can happen, but not necessarily do that themselves, because you don't want, it depends on how open the government is and how democratic it is to rely on the government to provide the content for you. So you have to be inside a very, very democratic country if you want to see that happening. But in my view, the government should allow the organizations to provide that and should allow the mechanisms to be able to share the content that is generated inside a country through kind of a rational strategy that allows you to find exactly what is going on. In terms of acquisitions and transparency and contracts and all that sort of things, of course, absolutely. Because it is all linked to the transparency of the government and how they provide accountability for the way they assign the resources they have. So, and there are many examples of that, not only in Macedonia, in Latin America, we have plenty, starting from Chile, in Colombia, in Mexico, there is huge, massive initiatives that are dealing with how to provide spaces for local municipalities to engage into the national processes, to link them into a rational way of doing things, to have a unique platform to apply for contracts or licitations, to sell your products online or things like that for the government, so the citizens can ask what the government is doing. But it's also a question about providing enough ground so other kind of content can also be find it and useful for the communities.
My name is Ben Petrosini. I'm IDRC, Latin America and the Caribbean. And basically wanted to follow up on some of the comments. I think it's been a nice session where some key elements have emerged. And many of us here in the room have known each other for about 15 years. Had been talking to each other for about 15 years. And I think we're in the doorsteps of having to say goodbye to each other and maybe meet once in a while, once a year, to share experiences of what we are doing in the various other areas, not anymore in the ICT area. And in that sense, I agree with David that I think if we keep talking to each other, we would have this gloomy view of how bad is access and how the digital divide is still yet to be overcome and so on. But if you look at how this sector has progressed in the last 15 to 20 years, compare it to health, education, access to justice and human rights and a number of other things that have to do with life, then I think it's time that we pat each other's in the shoulder, because I think I don't know if it's because of us. I don't think so, but whomever did it did a reasonably good job. So in that sense, I think it's good to hear that we're all fine-tuning to the notion that we should move. Probably at this stage, many of us should be sitting in a provincial health workshop and in a national educational event with heads of schools and so on. And I think we're right in the doorsteps of a significant change in the way we do things. And again, I agree with David that to move interns in that direction, we need a lot more evidence, because the work we do at IDRC is basically that. We do research to collect evidence, to provide policymakers and decision makers and NGOs and whomever takes a decision, an informed decision, a decision based on experience and so on, but still far away from convincing people that they should do this or that they should be confident that this is going to change their lives. So I think I'm glad the panel has worked this way, and I think we have an interesting time ahead of us. Thank you.
Just for scheduling, I'm planning on taking the 15 minutes that were stolen from us because of inefficiency earlier. But if people could please be helpful and keep your questions and comments quite brief, and the panelists as well, and the answers, it would really be helpful in getting the questions in. I know I at least have three on the floor right now.
Thank you. My name is Badru from Uganda. Badru Ntege from Uganda. I'd like to look at it from a slightly different angle. Jim Dempsey asked what different thing can happen, what has happened. When you look at, and again now I'm just going to talk again from the African perspective, and the issues on liberalization. If you look at the growth of the internet in the Western world, the internet was built on fixed infrastructure. The fixed infrastructure which was built on government PTOs before they were liberalized. So 80% of most of what the internet grew very first in the developed market was fixed infrastructure, which is already in the ground. in Africa, it was totally very different. Then again, when you look at when we came to the internet in Africa, it was the same time that the World Bank was coming up with this wild, wonderful idea of liberalization and the market forces. Well, market forces, when there is no economy to build market forces, cannot build the infrastructure for the internet. So we then push liberalization and ask that the market will make everything happen. But the market has no money to make everything happen. That's why it's been this slow growth that we see today. The problem is the internet is a global village. So as much as the constraints are understandable, we want the bandwidth now. The issue is we need to look at a different way of actually spearheading it, not to take what has worked best practice. And when we ask best practice, we look at best practice in the developed market, where everything is very different from the developing market. And I think that's what's gone wrong and that's what's missing. And if we start evaluating how we can look at it from the African perspective and from the developing markets perspective, I do believe the answer is there. And with the previous speaker, I do agree, we've done a lot. With the little we have, we've actually done a lot. I ran an ISP in Uganda for the last few years, and as much as we want to bring the cost of bandwidth down, it is not practically possible. It is not possible because the parameters are very, and we have a very good regulatory environment. So I can't blame the regulator, but something has to change in the equation to actually make it happen. And that's the question we need to look for. What is that that needs to be changed in the equation to make it happen? Not to look at best practice and try to put it in a place that doesn't fit.
Okay. My name is Mohamed. I'm from Senegal. My first foreign language is French. English is the second or third. So it's very difficult to express all the things I want to share with these two pillars that I have on the table. The one is on the demand side, and the other one is how we can be practical talking about the local, I mean, the access as a local challenge. I think that on all the point that the IGF have already defined, access is a much complex one. I'm not telling that it's, the other issues are not complex, or diversity is not a big one. But the challenges that access are facing in our environment is the most complex one compared to the issue in the IGF. But I want us to remember one thing. This IGF meeting have been drawn on the table based on the recommendation of the summit. And the summit have already put one document as a principle and the other document as an action plan. If we come to what is practical, what we can do in order to make things happen, what we're looking for during this meeting is to have new models, as he explained it, how we can move forward, is there any way we can do things differently than what we have before. I have been working for the telecom operator for over 7 years, but when I was working for the telecom operators, for me, access is only connectivity. We don't care about the content. I mean, we even phobiness to think about content. And we were the most stronger operator in that country, and nobody have to talk about content. We say that we don't care about what we are carrying, and nobody can sue us regarding the content of what we are carrying. And this is the case for Sonatel, France Telecom, and all the others regarding some hot topics. So we bring a technology, we set up networks, and after, we say what we're going to do for them, how we're going to use them. And I can give you very shortly my experience in my country regarding like health sector. I can tell you that people have spent over millions of dollars. But if you go and do like an evaluation, even in the center where you have the doctor working in one place, you can have more than 20 in a place. They even did not have a telephone line to talk to each other in a very close bureau, where when you call a center, people have to get from there, where they are doing, I mean, the diagnostic to the customer, walk for over 100 meters in order to answer call. I mean, when we're talking about access, we're talking about what can be done. While at the time, people are investing a lot of money on systems that did not work, because at a very high level, people are spending a lot of time trying to model some new system that are not tested, that are not for the welfare of the population. And people on the ground are doing, I mean, a step-by-step process. And if I recall what Nikeno is saying, and on the supply side,
what people are asking for is being able to communicate between them, being able to exchange information between them. They did not really ask for a 1 meg connectivity. I mean, these are the simple things, like when you get somebody who get an accident somewhere, you want to be moved from one place to the other, they just want a 2.4K can send the information to the other point in order to say that here's the patient, here are the characteristics of this guy, in order to save humans in an environment where technology are very pure. So the challenge, I mean, the access is the topics that can be declined into different issues. And I'm very glad that during that session that people did not see only access through connectivity, but access through the infrastructure, access through the critical internet resources, access to the application and to the useful use that we can get out from that environment. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. My first time in IGF. I'm Maui Sanford. I'm coming also like Rajnesh and Savi from the Pacific Islands. I'm president of the Pacific Island Telecommunication Association, and I'll be short. The main concern is internet, as you all know, is moving to a free world. Everything free, VOIP or anything. Also, following up the remarks from Uganda, my fear is in the future, how we are going, what the challenges are really heavy in Pacific Islands, maybe in some other countries also, due to the vast distances and small populations, as Rajnesh has said. My main concern is how the networks be able to support these, you know, free flows of information, almost. Who will pay for it? Most of the countries are developing countries. Funding that is coming to the region comes in a non-coordinated way. A fiber optic cable being laid in the Pacific, which is good, which will link the main capitals, but which will only link 30% of the total population. 60% are still there. So now that's the next challenge, how to reach them, to provide them access to information. So I really, my main purpose of being here is to try to talk to the main players, and the message to be how can we have a better coordinated approach to funding or aid or assistance to those projects, especially in LDC or developing countries. Thank you.
Any responses from the panel?
I guess I'll just react in general, if you don't mind. I still think this issue is a mind thing, is a will thing. It's none of these technologies or wires and no. Because I'm sure if a country like mine were to decide that they want to communicate with every citizen, there is a very simple way. I mean, I'm very convinced. I mean, the example Mohammed gave, I mean, people in the same office, they can't even pick the same tool and call themselves. So it's a mind thing that we are dealing with, and it's an orientation thing. That's why I started by, you know, trying to pull that out a little bit, okay, that we can do it, but we haven't quite committed ourselves to doing it, and that is really what I want to shift. And we are behaving quite elitist. I mean, I'm being very hard here, that we are happy that those of us in the metropolitan areas, we can communicate with outside. It's finished. No, where is our interest in communicating with our village? We only want to go there once a year? Where is that if the communication was there, you would be doing it every day. People in the village find a way to communicate with their children overseas to get the, to ask the children to bring back money. Okay, so why can't we do that the same thing within the country? So we have not owned the information site. If we own it, we will develop it.
I'm Hakika Rahman from Bangladesh. In fact, development, the panelists are so good, they point out all the things, so I'm afraid there's nothing new under the sun. Anyway, the development comes from bottom-up process or the top-down process. The government can take, say, South Korean model or Japan model. they don't only legalize, they also invest, government. But in our third world country, our developing country, sometimes government not only they don't invest, but they want to regulate. I think it was pointed out. The government should create enable a situation. But then my point is that it's very difficult when you try to, resonate your things towards development issues. I mean, not for profit issues like health, education, basic needs, environment. Those are the real challenges at the grassroots level. So you need their not only enable situation, some subsidy, cost subsidy, whatever you feel, because commercial people, they don't want to invest in those remote places. Technology are there maybe, the things came out also here nicely that deployment issue should be monitored. Selection of technology is important, but operational monitoring is far more important than deployment and selection of technology. Thank you.
I'm Walter Roseman. This isn't a question. I just wanted to say that, first of all, I agree with you very much, Nee, and also Valerie. I don't think it's an issue of relevance. And what will people say to each other? There is a classic commercial disaster in the history of the U.S. It's called Western Union Telegraph. And when Alexander Graham Bell came to Western Union with this wonderful new patent called the telephone and offered it to them, they said, no, we don't want it because we can't imagine what people would say to each other. I think we underestimate the ability to people, whether they're marginalized in rural areas or whatever, to come up with their own content. With, of course, some of the tutoring that Valerie is talking about, but of course, to come up with their own content. That's not the issue. I think we've discussed the infrastructure issues, but we skipped over, and there'll be some sessions later this week, we skipped over what you said, and that also is accessibility. And that is, once you've got the infrastructure, do you have the devices and the location of those devices and ways that people in rural areas, ways that women, for example, at night can get access to them, ways that people who are not literate can get access to them so that they can actually use them. Once all of that's in place, I quite agree that there's going to be no problem coming up with local or any other content.
Okay, I think we'll, any last comments from the panel before we wrap up?
The last thing that I wanted to say is that there is a lot of technologies that are developed or under development that are like the promise to solve these problems. Is the promise that they are going to solve this and that, and the way beyond that, let's wait for WiMAX until it's to reach one island to the next one and do that. But there's a lot of things that we can do with what we have, and we only need being more ingenious in the way to solve things. And just to close that comment, take a look of this Venezuelan interesting guy that is breaking world records, connecting at 389 kilometers of distance using a small Wi-Fi gear used in your offices that is cost $50 per unit to set up links that are able to transmit video and voice over 389 kilometers of distance. And they haven't finished the research yet. So it's a lot of things, interesting things that can be done with what we have, but we are lack of the initiative to change the paradigm and say, we can own the infrastructure. We can own the technology. We don't have only to buy boxes and connect them to do things. We can have open hardware that we can modify and do whatever we want. And we can have open software that help us to do things that we wanted to do. We can do extreme things using what we have. So there is just our lack of imagination and our belief in what the manufacturers said on their brochures. They don't even know really the power of the tools that they are selling. And the experience with us at the project with this research on long distance wireless links has been very interesting for Cisco, for example. They were just amazed that we do that with a WRGT access point. So that kind of things are like inspiring for many of us. And I think that we have to move that way and take the responsibility to shape the scenario and to own the infrastructure ourselves and do whatever we need to do.
Okay. Raj, and then we'll wrap up.
Thanks, Karen. Earlier it was said that ICT has developed at a rapid pace over the last 15, 20 years, perhaps. And in terms of access and connectivity issues, we are well on the way to solving a large part of it. I mean, there are efforts underway globally in various ways and forms. However, once we do get to the juncture where we've solved, well, we may never solve all the problems, but 80-90% of the problems, when we do solve that, a new larger problem will emerge, and that's one of security. Because by putting the next billion online, we're also putting the next most billion vulnerable people online. I mean, you have people who have very limited knowledge of what the internet is, but they want to get connected, they want to use the internet. At the same time, they are attracted to things like, you just won $1,000, please click here. There's phishing, there's, what's it called?
Foreign.
Identity, yeah, fraud, identity theft, fraud. I mean, there's all sorts of nasty things out there. So, whilst we are thinking about access and connectivity, I think we also need to start thinking about how are we going to protect this particular group of people who are about to come online and who may be the most vulnerable ever. That's all. Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, we'd like to wrap up. Thank you for staying over time. And once again, we have an absolutely fantastic panel and wish we could spend the whole afternoon with them. But thank you very much for attending.
Good to see you again.
Likewise.
Yes.
Likewise. You, David's been in touch with me too, so.
See you again.
With this consumer protection thing, so.
Oh, good.
So I think speaking with him as well.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent. Okay.
David,
I'm here from GSI.
Was it fruitful or what? Yeah.